Hi, Garnet Head Armstrong. You ever been accosted in an airport or a public place by some characters with their head shaved absolutely as bald as an egg, wearing a rather bedraggled sheet or some strange-looking garment, their feet encased in probably what appears to be rubber Korean shower sandals, with little symbols attached to their fingers, begging for money? I saw a group of these people standing on the street corner one time. They were doing a rather strange jig. I don't know what it was called, sort of the outer Korean jog or something like that, and clashing the little finger symbols together, shaved heads, bedraggled white robes, and I knew that those people were religious. Now, if I hadn't grown up knowing what these people were, the first time as a boy in Eugene, Oregon, I saw a couple of ladies approaching me with skirts flapping in the breeze, dressed in black, with funny-looking white hats. I would have run, climbed the nearest tree, and screamed for help. But because I had been informed as a boy growing up that those are nuns, those are religious people, it didn't frighten me. I had been educated, you see, to believe that when people dress up like that, you are supposed to understand they are religious people. In a public restaurant recently, a couple of friends of mine, I noticing a gal that was over there scooping out some of the food in the cafeteria line, hair severely pulled back, not an ounce of makeup anywhere in sight, a girl which could have been probably somewhat attractive, ugliest old pair of funny-looking brown horn-rimmed glasses like an antique out of the 1930s. And I nudged my partner and I said, "Do you suppose that lady is a religious person?" Now, I was in Hershey, Pennsylvania one time, and we were whizzing along at 55, breathtaking speed, on the turnpike. And there on a side road went a man dressed in black, with a severe black hat, with bushy sideburns and a full beard, and he was driving a buggy. It had pneumatic rubber tires, but it was being drawn by a horse. And I was told that he was one of the Amish folks that live in that part of Pennsylvania, who decided that the very best time, the very most righteous time in all of history, was probably sometime late in the 18th century. And that was when God kind of made time stop or stand still, and that was the way men ought to live. That everything and anything that has to do with modern technology, including the inventions such as the automobile, absolutely sinful. It's a sin to move one's body around the landscape faster than you can at an approximate 12 miles per hour behind a hay burner. That is righteous, and the people going by on the freeway were sinful. Furthermore, any kind of color in your clothing would be sinful. Now, where do people get these ideas? And does this idea of dressing in a uniform, doing funny things with your hands, standing in one method or another, using certain body English, does it really impress God? Is God sitting up there really being terribly impressed with the way people dress and the way people act? You can go as a curious tourist with your mouth full of gum and your proverbial two cameras swinging from your hip to some of the quaint Oriental countries and take pictures of some of the strange garb, and you look at it as kind of a curiosity. It is an interesting, quaint custom, you might say. Some of the garb of the priests of Nepal, for example. Or a wedding in Bangladesh. But when you stop to think that these people are practicing a religion which to them is a total absorbing way of life, an all-encompassing, all-demanding, day-by-day liturgical set of rituals by which their lives are ordered, and there is practically no nuance of human behavior, no thought, no gesture, no human activity which is not in some way totally governed by the codes of that religion. Now, how important is it, all of this business of skirt lengths and exact lengths of men and women's hair, whether or not facial hair is to be worn by men, the exact kind of shoes we ought to wear, whether high heels are sinful and jogging shoes are godly, whether rubber Japanese shower sandals and bare feet are more akin to what Christ and the disciples might have worn, And whether or not if you run around the street in a bedsheet with your head shaved, you're more righteous than some guy going by in a neat pinstripe suit with a briefcase on his way to his office. And how can you find out? Well, now, maybe it would occur to some of these people that they ought to ask God. Obviously, it has not, because if they looked into the Bible, there could be absolutely no basis whatsoever for strange garb to masquerade as religious clothing, because the Word of God never tells us at all in the New Testament any detail whatsoever about the method or mode of dress that was absolute law for the early New Testament apostles. When you are introduced to people, it never does in the New Testament the way we would expect in a novel, like the big, tall, 6'8", handsome, black-headed giant walked into town. He was an axe handle and a half broad across the shoulders. His weather-beaten countenance bespoke hours on a horse. He had little crinkled crow feet at the end of his eyes, and he had this handlebar mustache. You know, you're reading a novel, and they give you all of these descriptions so that you kind of form a mental image of exactly the size and shape and the general appearance of this individual. All novelists tend to do that. They introduce their characters in much the same way that you would be seeing a character in a motion picture or a television series. The Bible never does that. It says, here's Luke, you know, he was 5'10", he kind of brown-haired and this and that. No, it never does. Never tells us a single detail. But there are principles in the Bible that have to do, believe it or not, with clothing. For example, when you go back into the original story of the Garden of Eden, you come upon the world's greatest nudist colony. Now, the Bible shows very clearly that in the absence of sin, Adam and Eve, and they were possessed of human nature, by the way, were completely neutral toward God. Human nature being what it is, and of course carnal human nature from the time of Adam and the time that sin entered the world is, as I insist and have insisted for 27 years and will continue to insist because it's based upon the Bible, carnal human nature is vanity, jealousy, lust, and greed. It is swelling ego. It is narcissistic beyond belief. It is self-serving. It's as ugly as a bent, gnarled, twisted, ingrown old toenail. Carnal human nature is not pretty. It isn't pretty in little children. Little kids in public places who are as absolutely untrained, more untrained than your average chimpanzee in the zoo, that can drive adults to total distraction. You want to turn around when the kid is screaming on a many-decibeled shriek that threatens to absolutely break the dishes and the chandelier, and you want to ask the parent, does the kid do anything else? Can he climb walls? You know, or is that sound that he is making his only real cute trick? Now, in little sweet babies, and they are precious to us, they are carbon copies of ourselves, our own sons and daughters, our future heirs that we love so much. However, parents, I insist, children are far more intelligent than parrots. And if we can train parrots and dogs, we can train children. I really believe that. But those little children have human nature, carnal human nature. And as sweet as they are total self. Self-protection, self-satisfaction, self-determination, self-preservation, self-perpetuation, self-wants, self-desires. When they are very tiny little children, and they're learning a great deal merely by example, by sight, sound, smells, by impressions, and especially, of course, by parental example, even in their very first year, they learn more than they do the second year. The second year, they learn more than they will the third year. And so on right down through life. Knowledge is cumulative, and you would be surprised. Most parents don't have the faintest idea how much those little first-year children are learning, and they wait way too late to begin to teach these children so that they are disciplined and they are a child that will be able to recognize right values, that will recognize the rights and the property of other people, that will be respectful, a person of character, a person who is law-abiding, that is literally trained of the parent. But human nature, if it is not governed, if it is not controlled, if it is not directed, sometimes punished and suppressed, will be unbridled total self. Vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, ego, and narcissism. Now, when Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden, they were human beings and they had human nature. and they were just as naked as Jaybird. And Eve thought Adam was beautiful and didn't have the hang-ups that millions upon millions of women have because they're little, as little girls, their mothers fed them all of this stuff, and they were brought up under the various Freudian or Augustinian complexes, the one may be very ultra-conservative and the other perhaps hyper-liberal. And consequently, most people have sexual hang-ups almost like a mental disease. Eve didn't have any of those, and neither did Adam. When they were walking around the Garden of Eden without a stitch on, neither one of them thought the other was ugly. Adam did not constantly think of Eve as an object, a symbol, or like he was looking at the centerfold of a dirty magazine. There was nothing dirty about it. She was his wife, his beloved partner, his absolute equal. She was different, and he was glad. Now, they were absolutely neutral toward God. That is evident when you read the story, the account. God talked with them. They talked back. God saw what they were going to name the animals. They had a fine time doing that. They probably came up with more interesting names than we have today. When they saw an elephant go by, they didn't call him a thick skin. They called him a long nose. When they saw a hippopotamus, they didn't think it was a river horse. They thought it was river pig. Who knows? Maybe they attached different names to some of the creatures they saw than did the Greeks many centuries later. Maybe they never saw a fly fly, and they only watched him walk, so they called him a walk instead of a fly, walking on the ground. Look, a walk. Later on, somebody saw it fly and said, no, it's a fly. Well, Adam and Eve in their talks with God were totally neutral toward God. They were not hostile toward him. Hostility toward God was not part of human nature. It was something which gradually became to be, and in a sense was added, when they partook of a new dimension of knowledge, which was illegal knowledge, the knowledge of evil, of good and evil, the knowledge of sin, if you will, and immediately coming along with that as a consequence. Sex was not the sin. You know, some churches actually believe sex was the first sin. Nonsense. As a consequence of the first sin, and the first sin was the breaking of several direct points of the Ten Commandments, Adam and Eve became ashamed and embarrassed, and immediately sex organs, genitalia, became disgusting, hideous, and ugly, and the first thing they could think of, oh, we got to cover ourselves, we look horrible. But the sin was in partaking of something God told them not to take of. Direct rebellion toward their only father, coveting, lusting, reaching out to take, which was stealing, conspiracy, the two of them entering in together, Eve acting first, Adam docilely going along. And immediately, the proverbial fig leaves were sewn together, and you see that even God showed them how, by helping them to understand that they could use the skins of animals and how to make clothing for themselves. And that's the first account of human beings being clothed. Now, I've got to break off there, but it's an interesting subject I want to come back to complete next time in 1 Corinthians 11 about this business of hats on women's heads and whether they look better with a hat on their head with a daisy in the top of it in going into church or just with the hair that God gave them.